attack on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad is testing the American relationship with Iraq and also Iran's role there.
This is a culminating point for us. These militias and those who support them, like Iran, had better take notice. We are now playing hardball.
As for Iraqis, some say the recent events take them back to a darker time there.
We started to breathe a little bit better and to live a sense of normalcy. That's coming undone now.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, an Antarctic scuba diver takes us inside an iceberg.
The cave environment inside an iceberg is something that's ever changing. So the iceberg's melting, it's cracking, it's moving as you're diving in it.
And we chase down a mystery. Who really lays claim to inventing the Arabic typewriter? Those stories ahead on The World. We begin our coverage for 2020 in Iraq, and a second day of attempts to storm the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. Protesters hurled stones, and U.S. forces on the rooftop answered with tear gas. No demonstrators were able to breach the compound's gates today. The protesters, drawn largely from Iranian-backed militias, eventually stood down after the militia's leaders told them to stop. But a spokesman for the militia said the sit-in around the compound will continue until the embassy is closed and the ambassador is expelled. So let's hear from a former ambassador to Iraq. Ryan Crocker served as U.S. ambassador there from 2007 to 2009, and he later served as ambassador to Afghanistan. Now, it's a tricky time in Iraq right now. Iraqi citizens are protesting their own government, while Iranian-backed militias are attacking the U.S. embassy after deadly American airstrikes last weekend in Iraq and Syria. So I asked Crocker how these dueling protest movements complicate the U.S. diplomatic approach in Iraq.
The U.S. diplomatic approach to Iraq has always been complicated. We just have a few more layers here. We've seen a sequence of activities now, the airstrikes that we launched a few days ago, and then, of course, the response after the funeral yesterday. So does it make it more difficult? Oh, I think it does. The United States has got to figure out what's the game plan here. I hope they have one, because the attack on the embassy, I think, was foreseeable. That there would be some kind of response after the air raids.
Do you think that the U.S. kind of retaliating for the American contractor who was killed and the U.S. retaliation involving killing Iraqis on Iraqi soil, was that kind of a bridge too far?
We will see. Right now, it appears that with the attack on the embassy, which, of course, did not penetrate the embassy buildings, just over the wall, that may be an event that causes everybody just to push the hold button here. I am not day-to-day on or minute-to-minute on this, but I understand that we now have Kataib Hezbollah and supporters camped out in front of the embassy, outside the wall, with a Kataib spokesman saying, we're taking this to Parliament to get legislation to compel the Americans to leave. So maybe we have it parked for a moment, at least in terms of kinetic action. This is a culminating point for us. These militias and those who support them, like Iran, had better take notice. We are now playing hardball, but that is not the way they framed it. What worries me is, does the administration have a game plan? And I just, I am fearful, and I'm sure others in Baghdad are fearful too, that we don't really have a coherent game plan.
I want to step back a moment and ask you to explain in general, what are American interests in Iraq currently?
Our overriding interest in Iraq is our own national security, which, of course, is why we intervened militarily after 2014 and the Islamic State surged through Iraq. We could not let that stand. It is dangerous to the region. It's dangerous to the United States. Connected to it would be checking Iranian malign influence in Iraq to the extent that we can do it. It means maintaining a robust presence on the ground, military and civilian, to send the message, we have vital strategic interests here. The Iranians have got to understand that. And if they take a set of actions that are contrary to those interests, folks are going to pay for it. A third, being in Iraq to check Iranian expansion, again, to the extent we can. And a fourth and final one, for me at least, would be doing whatever we can to support the development of a solid institution based, rule of law based Iraqi democracy.
As you know, the Afghan papers were recently released, and they showed very vividly how the U.S. really sunk in the Afghani mud for decades. In Iraq, it's been 16 years since Saddam Hussein was captured and his regime overthrown. In the case of Iraq, why do you think staying engaged is so important?
We have seen pretty clearly what happens when we completely check out, which is what the Obama administration did. Failing to obtain a follow-on agreement to the comprehensive bilateral agreement that I negotiated in 2008. What happened? The Iranians had free rein in the south and the east, and Islamic State moved into the west and to the north. And that caused us to reengage. So it's right there in front of us. If we say we're done here, there are others only too happy to move into that space, as they've already demonstrated. So it's not hypothetical. It is not something the Iraqi government or the vast majority of the Iraqi people want to see. They want us there as a balance.
But what's the alternative? Just hanging in forever?
Well, look, you have got a situation now in Iraq where with a relatively small number of troops, I would say that level of presence, more or less, is a pretty cheap insurance policy to see that we don't get another 2014 and the rise and resurgence of a very tenacious enemy, which is Islamic State / Al-Qaeda. Again, core interest of ours, it is our own national security, which is why having a coherent policy that says these are things we will not tolerate and backing them up with targeted military actions, I think, is important.
Ryan Crocker has served as U.S. ambassador to many countries in the Middle East, including Iraq and Afghanistan. Ambassador Crocker, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Tensions may be easing today around the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, but underlying concerns about an escalation between Iran and the United States are not going away. So how do Iraqis feel about being caught in the middle? I spoke earlier with Baghdadi businessman and consultant Hassan Haddad. Haddad spent much of his life in Canada, but returned to Iraq in 2013 to start anew.
The biggest losers in yesterday's attack against the U.S. embassy will be the Iraqi people and the Iraqi government, because it is the responsibility of the Iraqi government to protect these sites.
What about Sunday's U.S. attacks in Iraq and Syria, which killed a number of Iraqis on Iraqi soil?
That is an escalation of the so far Cold War between the Americans and the Iranians. And it's not a good escalation because Iraq is caught in the middle. And we see that with that strike, it was Iraqis on Iraqi soil that were targeted. If things continue to escalate, it will be the average Iraqi that bears the brunt. And that is not something that we Iraqis want after several years of wars and sanctions and terrorism, and most recently the war against ISIS. We started to breathe a little bit better and to live a sense of normalcy. That's coming undone now with these escalations between the Americans and the Iranians. So, you know, everybody in the government, most people on the street have said, if you can just take this fight away from our neighborhood and just do it somewhere else, if you need to fight, don't do it here, because we know what the repercussions will be.
I think it's fair to say that you've been generally supportive of the U.S. mission in Iraq over the years. Is that right?
I'm supportive of Iraq becoming a democratic country that has its sovereignty respected and can stand on its own two feet. If that is done by aligning ourselves with the United States, or if that is done by aligning with Iran, I think the ends justify the means. However, having been in this country for several years, I can tell you that we cannot stand on our own two feet without having friendly and balanced relations with all, including the United States.
So how far is Iraq from standing on its own two feet?
I think we're two generations away from that, and I am an optimist. But I think in order to get to that point, there's a lot of serious hard work that needs to be done.
There have been mass protests in Baghdad over the past few months against corruption and to some extent against Iranian influence. What's your opinion of them? These protests are totally different from what's been going on with this Iran-backed militia.
The protests started 3 months ago on the 1st of October, and it's been a mix of demands that people have been seeking, one of them being combating corruption, because corruption is so rife in this country. And so people are tired of that. They just want to have, you know, good health care, good education system, and to have a job that, you know, they can look forward to.
And do you support them?
The protests?
Yes.
Of course, these are Iraqi youth who want a better future. What it all boils down to is they want somebody who's a national leader, who's got a clear vision for the country, which will inspire hope. We're missing those three things: national leadership, a clear vision, and hope.
Hassan, how have the events of the past couple of weeks affected you personally?
I mean, on a practical level, there are streets that are closed. There are days where kids can't go to school, teachers can't make it to class, things like that. So practically speaking, life has been disturbed since the 1st of October. It is hoped that all of this disturbance and sometimes nuisances are for the greater good, which is a better future than we've had. So people, if they think big picture, they're not too disturbed by it. But on the day-to-day, it's quite difficult on the day-to-day level to do a simple task like go shopping or get to work.
Are you committed to staying in Iraq forever?
Yes, I don't have any tickets booked to go back home yet. This is home.
Iraqi businessman Hassan Haddad speaking to us from Baghdad. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
People around the world last night rung in the new year with fireworks and revelry. But many cultures will get to do New Year's twice, starting in a few weeks with the Chinese or Lunar New Year. Millions of people around the world will usher in the Year of the Rat with fireworks and performances. Since 1996, Hong Kong has held a parade to mark the occasion, but the parade will not go on as planned this year because of ongoing protests along the route. Instead, Hong Kong will hold a carnival to celebrate. Also in March, the beginning of Nowruz, the Persian New Year. Around 300 million people in Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan will celebrate, as will Kurds and other ethnic groups, people like Masood in London.
For me, it's been brought down through my generation. We've been told about the culture of Iran and the celebration of the new year, which brings new light of spring into action for the year. And it's such a time to be joyful.
Then the end of March brings Nyepi, a public holiday in Indonesia. It's a day of silent meditation and fasting to commemorate the Balinese New Year. Pretty different than last night's scene. On September 11th, Ethiopians and Eritreans will celebrate their New Year, Enkutatash, which coincides with the end of the rainy season. Jews the world over observe Rosh Hashanah in the fall. September 18th marks the 5,780th year of the Jewish calendar. And mid-November will mark Diwali, the five-day Hindu festival of lights. Millions of Hindus, Sikhs, and Jains around the world will celebrate the spiritual triumph of good over evil. How about a little Bollywood to get us in the spirit? Whenever you celebrate, Happy New Year. You're with the world. There are still a few places on Earth that have had fewer visitors than the moon. Just ask Jill Heinerth. She's a filmmaker and technical diver. In 2000, she embarked on one of her most ambitious projects, diving inside an iceberg. Heinerth led a National Geographic team to Antarctica and the B-15 iceberg. It was so big, it seemed to blot out the horizon. The team decked out in special dry suits to combat the freezing temperatures and prepared to film something no one else had ever seen – Heinrich says the iceberg was awe-inspiring, but capturing those images came with risks.
We narrowed down ourselves to a place where we saw this large blue vertical line like cutting into this massive piece of ice. And we thought, well, we'll enter there and see what we can find. You know, just going to Antarctica feels like going to another planet. You're so remote. There's no contrails in the sky. There's no sounds that you're so used to in terms of the background noise of life. And you feel like a flea on the back of the planet. And then to finally go inside the iceberg and enter this blue vertical crack was breathtakingly beautiful and foreign and unlike anything I'd ever seen before. It's a little bit disarming and confusing at first until you descend a little bit and finally, you know, reach this beautiful transparent blue water and your first vision of the ice underwater. We started to swim into this crack, unaware of where it would lead us. No one had ever been there before. We had no idea how deep it would go. And the walls to either side of me looked like the surface of a golf ball, you know, rutted with dimples that had been carved by the hand of the sea. And there were layers in the ice, transparent, clear layers. And as I descended passing these layers, I felt like I was going back in time because every layer might have represented a year or a decade of snow or ice that had been laid down on top of Antarctica. There was no daylight, so we brought our own lights and illuminated this archway of the beautiful ice above us that was also still riddled with cracks. And there were amphipods the size of my hand, sort of like a cross between cockroaches and spiders. And they were dropping out of these cracks and crawling along on the seafloor on this carpet of red and yellow and orange filter-feeding organisms. So all of a sudden, we were just surrounded by life. These filter-feeding organisms are kind of crackling and popping, almost like that candy called Pop Rocks that you would put in your mouth and it would fizz and pop. Kind of sounded like that. But also the ice was cracking and groaning and moving and creating both sounds and these feelings that would just reverberate through the sternum of my chest. After a few minutes of shooting footage, I feel the current starting to pick up. But the other thing I feel is this ominous prickle of cold seeping into the glove of my left hand. I had a puncture in my dry glove, and now it's starting to fill up with freezing cold water. Some of it's starting to sort of creep up the wrist seal in my dry suit a little bit, but mostly it's just absolutely killing my left hand. So I turn to the guys and I give the thumbs up. We gotta go. I can't stand this cold in my hand anymore. I hope we've got enough footage. Let's turn around. And as we turned around, it was like the current accelerated in the course of a minute or two to something we hadn't even experienced before. And I dove my sort of dead-feeling hand into this doughy seafloor, and this big puff of clay kind of comes up. And I realized that I have to hang on with everything I can just by burying my hands into the silt. In order to not get sucked into the iceberg, I thought, I do not want to do that again. I want to go out the same way we came in, because that's what we agreed on before the dive. And now we are fighting with everything we have, every inch of strength, to get back to that crevice that leads us back to the surface. It was absolutely terrifying. It was really for the first time on that trip that I thought, oh, wow, we might not be getting out of this one. The only people to rescue us are already in the cave. So we finally get back to this crack, this vertical crack that will lead us to the surface again. But the current is barreling down the crack, that's pressing us down to the seafloor. And I think, how am I going to climb the ice wall? I can't compete against this current. So I looked to the life that I had been documenting, these tiny little clear ice fish about the size of my thumb that had burrowed these little holes in the ice wall. And they would hide there when the currents were strong. And I could see their little eyes poking out of the holes. And I thought, aha, these I could use like climbing leads. You know, I could jam my finger into a hole, pull myself up, and use this to work back towards the surface. I swam back to the boat, and as I climbed the boarding ladder, the chief scientist was hanging over, looking down at me, and he was very concerned because we'd been very much overdue. And I looked up at him and I said, "Greg, the cave tried to keep us today. That was terrifying. That was a close call." So we thought, all right, let's post a watch on deck, and they can tell us when the current hits slack. And generally, when you hit slack tide, you've got 40 minutes clear before it turns around and starts to pick up in the other direction. And so that's what we did. The gear was ready, we ate a meal, and we waited. And then we heard screams. We gathered up the camera and ran up on deck, and I could not believe what I was seeing. The entire iceberg that we'd just been inside of was now crumbling and breaking apart and dissolving into the sea, heaving up this massive wave as it did so. It took probably 15 minutes for the whole thing to break apart. Well, we just stood there, our jaws dropped, until all we could see was endless blocks and chunks and slush on the surface, as far as the eye could see. If I'd have been in there, I wouldn't be here with you today. It taught me some incredibly important lessons. I've spent a lot of time since then in the polar regions documenting climate change, and it terrifies me every summer when I go up to the Arctic and I film and I see the changes. It's gut-wrenching to see how it's affecting the people of the North, the wildlife of the North, and then, of course, our global climate. So I think, in a way, you know, 18 years ago, global climate change may have tried to kill me, and I'm around today maybe to be one of those voices that help people see and understand what's happening to our world.
That's Jill Heinerth telling her story to the BBC. We've got a mystery to unravel. Who really invented the typewriter, the Arabic one?
This was a cupboard that, you know, I had always known belonged to my grandfather, okay? And it was always locked.
Inside the cupboard was a treasure chest of documents and patents. The first Arabic typewriter coming up on the world. For the rest of our New Year's Day show today, we have a story of two rival inventors. One invention, two men. An Egyptian and another man from what was at the time called Greater Syria. Both of these men claim to have invented the Arabic typewriter. Yes, the Arabic typewriter, for writing in Arabic. The typewriter script goes from right to left. It also has 28 letters. Its invention was a whole lot more complicated than just changing the letters on a standard Latin alphabet typewriter. For businesses and governments, writing in Arabic in the early years of the 20th century, the Arabic typewriter was transformational.
But as inventions go, there's only one inventor, right?
That's Heba Fisher from the podcast Kerning Cultures, here now with a tale of two inventors.
So what's the true version of history? We're going to try and figure it out with you today. Our story starts with a man named Waleed Waqed.
My name is Waleed Waqed. What do you want to know?
What do you do for a living? Where do you live?
So I currently live in New Zealand. I've been living there for the past almost 10 years now. And I work as a doctor, as an urgent care physician. But I was born in Egypt.
And growing up, Waleed's great-grandfather was something of a legend in the family.
He's basically the sole inventor of the Arabic typewriter, it kind of wasn't as important to me back then. You know, my parents passed away when I was still a teenager. So it wasn't until I became a little bit more mature in my 20s is when I rediscovered this whole typewriter stuff. And that's mainly because I had moved to Egypt and was living with my grandmother.
And at his grandparents' place, there was this old cupboard.
This was a cupboard that, you know, I had always known belonged to my grandfather, okay? And it was always locked. And I remember my grandma had the key. And so I asked my grandmother to give me the key so I can open it up. And it was like, you know, discovering a treasure chest full of very important documents that I knew there was a typewriter, but I didn't know there was a patented in the U.S. of all places. I'm like, why does it say Philippe Wecked, United States citizen? Certainly that didn't pass down to me. As I read more and more through these documents, I realized, oh my gosh, you know, this is way beyond what I had grown up to think this was. And I was just struck at the time. I knew right then and there, you know, here I am, a descendant of Philippe Wecked. Probably, had I not decided to go to Egypt, live with my grandmother, open that cupboard, this stuff would have been buried for life, you know?
I have a vague recollection of him mentioning something once. He was saying that his great-grandfather actually had a patent.
This is Ahmed Edethi, one of Waleed's childhood friends. Ahmed and Waleed have known each other since the early 1990s, when they used to play in a band together. Now, though, Ahmed works at the American University of Cairo.
I currently run the technology transfer office at the American University in Cairo.
A technology transfer office is basically where they deal with patents.
I deal with inventions. It's in any field. So typically, my typical, let's say, beginning of a case is an inventor or researcher walking through the door from any random field you can imagine and saying, hey, I have invented this new molecule that could cure so-and-so, or this new method for manufacturing a steel component.
Ahmed's job in patents meant that he was kind of the perfect person to unravel what came next.
What happened was a friend of mine called Mohammed al-Shahid here in Egypt. Basically, he was commissioned by the British Museum to set up a modern exhibit for Egypt. So he reached out to all of his friends, started asking, does anybody have anything that is worth putting up in the museum? And I vaguely remember, like, I recollected these conversations or mentions by Waleed. So I reached out to him and he said, sure, get in touch with my uncle. I got in touch with his uncle. We went to his old apartment. He opens this old cupboard. And lo and behold, he basically gives me this treasure trove of documents. And that's really where things got a little crazy, I would say.
So this is how it started. When Ahmed went over to Waleed's uncle's place to check out this old patent that might make a good display for this museum exhibit.
They brought me in, served me tea, I want to say like biscuits maybe or something of the sort. And then he sort of sat down and then he hands me the documents. You know, he makes me read through one or two with him. To him, it was clearly very precious. He clearly had a very strong personal feeling or connection about this. I would say they probably numbered in the 40, 50 documents. And it was a lot of letters, a lot of, like I said, receipts, a lot of blueprints.
And the first thing he did was to lay out all the documents in chronological order. And when he started to look through all of these papers trying to map out the story that Waleed's great-grandfather, Philippe Wecked, had invented the Arabic typewriter, Ahmed actually found another version of history, a rival version.
No doubt it's Selim Haddad. I mean, it's obvious that Selim Haddad was the first inventor. nobody contests. The one who registered the patent was Selim Haddad.
This is Alexander Qurdahi. His great-uncle was cousins with Selim Haddad. He's the closest living relative to Selim we could find.
My name is Alexander Qurdahi. I'm French. I was born in Egypt. I'm Lebanese too. And I also am a lawyer and professor. I speak very badly, five languages. I speak well French.
So Alexander started to tell us his version of who invented the Arabic typewriter.
My grandfather, who wrote to me letters and with whom I spoke, I must say that my grandfather was born in 1888. And my great chance is that he lived till 1984.
His grandfather would write to him stories of their family history, how their relative Selim Haddad invented the first Arabic typewriter in a time in Egypt called An-Nahda, or the Renaissance, in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
There was a moment of takeoff of Egypt with Egyptians of all confessions, sects, with foreigners, Lebanese, Syrians, from the Ottoman place, and Egypt was taking off like Japan.
Think of a vibrant art scene, intellectuals gathering in coffee shops to debate politics and religion, so much good literature, and a lot of innovation and entrepreneurship.
It really does paint a very, very vibrant picture of Egypt, and I'd even say the region in, you know, that particular period of time.
So here's what we know. Selim Haddad, Alexander's great-uncle's cousin, was originally Syrian, born in 1864.
I know that he was born in Damascus, and he basically was a painter there. And he felt that the market in Syria was not that great, so he moves to Egypt for better opportunity. He comes down to Egypt. He becomes very popular with the rulers there, the rich there, because he becomes a very famous painter who draws their portraits. And at some point, he picks up an interest in typewriters. He starts working on them.
And here's what we know about Philippe Wekids, Walid's great-grandfather.
Philippe was born in 1871 in Beirut.
He moved to Egypt at some point, and by 1890, he was working for the Ministry of Interior there.
And what I'm telling you right now is basically everything that I know from the notes that I got from his family. One of the reasons why I know a lot about the story, actually, is thanks to an article that was written in Al-Ahram in 1939. Philippe Wekid passed away in 1919, and you'd imagine that that would be the end of the trail for me. But in reality, what happens is that in 1939, Selim Haddad passes away. And a journalist in Al-Ahram decides to basically give an homage to Selim Haddad, tell the story of what he sees as the inventor of the Arabic typewriter.
It's a tribute to Selim Haddad, published in Egypt's biggest daily newspaper, Al-Ahram. In it, the journalist commemorates the life and contributions of Selim Haddad as the inventor of the Arabic typewriter. It's dated August 3rd, 1939.
2 days later, I have basically a memo or a letter from Georges Wekid, the son of Philippe Wekid. And you could tell even from the tone that he was livid. He was basically, this is absolutely not true. I must basically defend the honor of my father. So it reads as follows.
Dear kind sir, I am an avid reader of your newspaper column about forgotten history. I read your obituary of Selim Haddad and saw that you mentioned that he is the inventor of the Arabic typewriter. But this is an injustice to the real inventor of the first Arabic typewriter, so I wanted to write to you to let the real truth be known. The first inventor of the Arabic typewriter is my late father, Philippe Wekid. He was mesmerized by the Western version of the machine and insisted on making an Arabic version. So in his spare time, he would try to achieve this goal. He bought himself a Remington machine and made Arabic letters for it out of rubber, which he stuck onto the Latin letters, then connected the Arabic letters to each other.
So after this memo that Georges Wekid sent to the Ahram, what happens is The journalist basically takes in George Weckert's notes, and he actually writes an article detailing everything that was said. So he basically reiterates what was written in the letter. And this basically appears on the 18th of October. On the 23rd of October, a third article shows up. Clearly, the family of Salim Haddad read the rebuttal and basically sent another letter saying that, no, here's the truth. And obviously, when you read through them, you see that there are some facts that don't add up. So somebody is, I'm not going to say telling the truth, but these are two different viewpoints of the truth.
But then Ahmed learns the plot thickens further. Let's rewind to 50 years prior, in Chicago, in the United States. It's 1893, and there's an event called the Chicago Fair. It's a huge exhibition of technologies from around the world. Each country has their own pavilion, and Egypt was one of the countries participating.
So it was basically a reenactment of basically an Egyptian street, but obviously very much sort of Disneyfied, I would say. So like there were a lot of belly dancers, lots of camels. And for whatever reason, they thought that we were going to put an Arabic typewriter there. So it only shows up in a few travelers' diaries where they say that they were walking through sort of like, you know, the streets of Cairo in Chicago. And they stumble upon, you know, this crowd that was just like, you know, completely bedazzled by something and were making all sorts of funny sounds.
The thing making weird sounds in the corner was an Arabic typewriter. An early prototype of an Arabic typewriter, actually, which was produced in the UK by an American company, by people who Ahmed suspects didn't speak or write Arabic.
What seems to be, or at least my theory, is that it probably did not function very well. And also, it's very likely that the people who made it did not speak Arabic, because at the very least, I have not found any references to anybody who has made or who has contributed to making that particular machine.
Nevertheless, that machine on display at the 1893 Chicago World Fair was important, because also at the fair that year, somewhere amongst the crowds of belly dancers and fake Egyptian street sellers, were our two main characters, Philippe Weckert and Salim Haddad.
My theory is that both of them saw it. Both of them saw the potential, but also both of them saw the flaws in the machines. And both of them came back and said, we are going to work on something that's better. And I don't know how big the Chicago Fair was, but they must have bumped into each other.
There's a bit of a gap in the timeline now. Between 1893 and 1899, we don't have any records to know for sure what the two of them spent these 6 years doing. But Ahmed has a theory.
Maybe they were in, you know, their garages, or, you know, the equivalent of a garage, basically working on the machines this whole time and trying to figure out and trying to perfect it to a point where it was actually an improvement over what they saw.
Still to come, Ahmed Alethi unearths the first document ever typed on an Arabic typewriter. But which machine produced it? Philippe Weckert's or Salim Haddad's? Heba Fischer returns with part two of A Tale of Two Inventors in just a few moments. We've been going back in time today to the very end of the 19th century, when two inventors, Philippe Weckert and Salim Haddad, both claimed to have invented the Arabic typewriter. But who was the true inventor? Here with the conclusion of A Tale of Two Inventors is Heba Fischer.
In August 1899, a patent for the first Arabic typewriter was filed by Salim Haddad. 3 months later, on December 1st, 1899, a British patent was filed by Philippe Weckert. But, and this is kind of where things get interesting, Ahmed also found in that box from Walid's family a letter that Philippe Weckert had typed and sent to the Minister of Interior in Egypt, remember, one of his employers. It's dated May 9th, 1899, 3 months before Salim's patent was filed.
So on May 9th, 1899, I have the first typed document to Al-Mustashar Mishir Al-Akram. So It starts with like the place and date. So it says, مصر في 9 مايو سنة 1899.
With respect, I present to you the first printed writing in Arabic. And no doubt you can see that the writing hasn't appeared as it should. I've been experimenting and have grafted the Arabic letters onto a Latin machine. And after much effort, I was able to write down these words. According to Ahmed's research, this is the first document ever typed with an Arabic typewriter, by Philippe Wekids, Walid's great-grandfather. It came 3 months before Salim Haddad filed the patent for his Arabic typewriter. I think one of the things that struck us about this story is the fact that none of this history is properly documented. Ahmed spoke to a lot of typographers and historians, and the rightful title of inventor of the Arabic typewriter seems to be up for grabs.
I think even through the research, reading the patents and everything, it's very hard to pinpoint one person.
This is Professor Negla Bedron. She's an adjunct professor specializing in Arabic typography at the American University of Cairo.
Most likely it is both Salim Haddad and Philippe Wekid.
Because here's the thing. If we define invention by whatever came first, then it would be the clumsy Arabic typewriter that Salim Haddad and Philippe Wekid saw at that Egyptian corner of the Chicago Fair in 1893. But that one didn't really work, right? However, if we define invention by the first useful version of the machine, then it'd be either Salim Haddad or Philippe Wekid, and who you pick depends on whether you believe the claim goes to the one who filed the patent first, Salim Haddad, or who made the thing that worked first, Philippe Wekid, typing the first printed document in Arabic. Anyhow, both men found success off the back of their typewriters. In 1904, Philippe Wekid had started selling his, and by February of 1912, his shop on Maligi Streets in Cairo had sold 100 of his Arabic typewriters.
Oh, that's not that many, actually.
That's producer Alex Atak.
For some reason, I expected more. But is that a lot to you?
I would say that is a lot. So you do have to keep in mind that basically typewriters were not something that people would buy on their own. So this wasn't something that would be a personal machine. These were more for businesses and for government. And it seems that their primary client were the government.
Mainly for administrative use, because at the time, most government documents were still handwritten.
Also, I would say that they probably did a good living because they were selling the machines for 20 Egyptian pounds. So it wasn't an amount that basically a person would be able to afford. It's clearly a lot of money. So I want to say that cars were going for that much.
And around this time, there are papers Ahmed found indicating that Philippe Wekid actually sued Salim Haddad for copyright infringement. But the documents don't lead anywhere conclusive, and we're not entirely sure what happened with that court case. Suffice it to say, from what we can tell, the two men were definitely aware of one another and clearly didn't want to work together. And this is how things carried on for the two of them. They worked in parallel, independently trying to bring their inventions into the world. Then in 1919, when Philippe Wekid was on his way back to Egypt from a trip to the United States,
he catches cholera on the boat. He gets quarantined as he arrives in Egypt and he dies.
Philippe Wekid died in October of 1919. Salim Haddad died 20 years later in the hospital in the summer of 1939. Salim was in his 70s. Both men had proven the commercial viability of the Arabic typewriter. So in 1919, when their original patents expired,
what we see at that point is maybe 6, 7, 8, even 9 companies popping up. So all these Arabic typewriter businesses start popping up. And all what's happening is, you know, now it's in the open domain, all these developments that Philippe Wekid and Salim Haddad developed.
And from there, as we know, the designs became better, the machines became cheaper, and Arabic typewriters became ubiquitous around the Arab world. And as far as family legacy goes,
prior to Ahmed's research, everything was pretty binary to me, you know?
This is Walid Wekid again, Philippe Wekid's great-grandson who found that box of documents at his grandmother's house.
There was one Arabic typewriter. Somebody had to invent it. It was either Philippe Wekid or Salim Haddad. But the reality of it, you know, is quite different. You know, they were both innovators. I guess my legacy is to, you know, take a snapshot of that part of history, which I believe has been left out about Philippe Wekid, and just make it public and say, hey, yes, there was Selim Haddad, but there was also Philippe Wekid, who had also a pretty major role. And this is something to also inspire you to be productive in life. You know, at least for me, just knowing that story, you know, it just puts me to shame when I think about what I've done in my life, and inspires me to want to do something helpful, creative, and to put it out there.
As for Alexander Qardahi, he's pretty sure that his great-uncle's cousin, Selim Haddad, was the rightful inventor. He was, after all, the first to file a patent. But Alexander told us inventions don't come from a vacuum.
We are dwarfs on the shoulders of giants, don't we say this? There's a book of Norbert Elias on Mozart, and when he speaks of the birth of a genius, it's a very small book, and he explains very well. What is the birth of genius? At the same time, it's the relationship, if you wish, between the individual and the society, the person and the structure. It's not out of the blues. If it comes somewhere, it is linked to the system, to the structure. However, thanks God, the individual can do something, can invent.
A Tale of Two Inventors came to us from Kerning Cultures, a podcast telling stories from the Middle East and the spaces in between. The reporter was Heba Fisher. The producers were Nadine Shaker and Alex Atek. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Happy 2020.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.